Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
7 hours GMT, and this is Weekend with Owen Bennett-Jones. And coming up in this hour, we'll be hearing from Hong Kong, where elections of a sort are taking place days after the deadliest fire in the city for decades. Also, a year on from the downfall of the Assad regime, we'll hear how some Syrian exiles feel about returning home.
This year when I went back, I felt that, yes, I want to go back to my country, but I also didn't feel very well to bring back my children there, to be honest.
And why the British public has chosen this as its all-time favourite Christmas movie.
When the McAllister family left on their Christmas vacation...
Did we miss the flight? No, you just made it.
Yeah!
They forgot one small thing. Alone.
That's all coming up. Lots more too. All after this news bulletin.
Hello, I'm Eileen McHugh with the BBC News. At least 25 people have been killed and dozens injured in the Indian state of Goa after a fire ripped through a nightclub. Eyewitnesses say at least 100 people were on the dance floor when the fire broke out. Our reporter Vikas Pandey is outside the club.
This area is very popular among partygoers. It's dotted with a lot of clubs, and last night was Saturday, so most of the clubs were full. Loud music was being blasted, people were dancing and enjoying themselves. Then all of a sudden at around 1 o'clock, loud screams started coming out from Birch, and one eyewitness who was just outside the club told us that when he rushed to the gate, he saw people just trying to escape and rush and running in all directions. And what he described as one part of the club had turned into a ball of fire.
Russia has carried out new missile and drone attacks overnight targeting infrastructure in central Ukraine. Talks aiming to end the war have intensified in Europe and the US. Ukraine's President Zelensky will meet the leaders of Britain, France and Germany on Monday. Here's Joe Inwood.
This meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, British and French-led supporters of Ukraine, is designed to reiterate the fact that Kyiv still has friends, even as relations with Washington have grown more distant. Europe has been increasingly sidelined by the US-led efforts to find a negotiated settlement to a conflict that has, so far, proved intractable. President Zelensky said a phone call with Donald Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, and the US leader's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was very constructive. What is not yet clear is whether there has been genuine progress or if Mr. Zelensky is simply trying to remain positive for fear of angering the US president.
Elections are taking place in Hong Kong days after the deadliest fire in the city for decades. The authorities have urged people to come out and vote, even though only 20 of the 90 seats in the legislature are directly elected. The German Chancellor Friedrich Merz is in Israel, where he's due to hold talks with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. James Cook reports from Jerusalem.
Friedrich Merz's first trip here as Chancellor comes 2 months after an unsteady ceasefire came into effect as part of a US-led peace plan. After talks in Jordan, Mr. Merz called for Hamas to lay down its arms, more aid for Gaza, and a clear path to Palestinian statehood. His meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu is likely to focus on the next stage of the peace plan. Under a so-called Board of Peace, headed by President Trump, this is supposed to include an international security force in Gaza, a new governing authority, the disarmament of Hamas, and Israel's eventual withdrawal from the territory.
James Cook, reporting from Jerusalem. This is the latest world news from the BBC. Observers from the Organization of American States have called for vote counting in Honduras to speed up a week after the presidential election took place. With almost 90% of votes counted, the Conservative National Party candidate Nasri Asfura has a slender lead over his centrist rival Salvador Nasralla. Officials say around 14% of ballots have shown inconsistencies. Japan says Chinese fighter jets directed their radar at Japanese military aircraft in two separate incidents on Saturday. Both encounters happened over international waters southeast of Okinawa Island. Japan's defense minister described the incidents as dangerous acts by Beijing. The Chinese Navy disputed Tokyo's account. Australia has declared natural disasters in six areas in New South Wales, where fire crews are battling dozens of wildfires fueled by soaring temperatures. One of the most destructive blazes destroyed more than 12 homes and vast areas of bushland in the state's central coast region just north of Sydney. The Formula One Championship will be decided later today in the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, in which one of three men can claim the title. McLaren's Lando Norris leads the standings by 12 points, but he's being chased by four-time world champion Max Verstappen, racing for Red Bull. Joe Curry reports.
It's being billed as the most exciting Formula One title race in years, but who will win? Britain's Lando Norris starts in second on the grid, but he knows if he crosses the finish line in the top three, he'll claim his first ever world title. But hot on his heels will be his McLaren teammate, the Australian Oscar Piastri, and Red Bull's Max Verstappen from the Netherlands, the reigning champion. At one point during the season, the Dutchman was more than 100 points off the pace, but mistakes by McLaren have put him back in contention. He starts on pole today, eyeing a fifth consecutive championship.
BBC News.
It's 7.06 GMT. You're listening to Weekend from the World Service of the BBC with Owen Bennett-Jones. And coming up a little later, a new documentary that highlights how high-ranking politicians and officials in the United States are seeking full disclosure about what's known on unidentified flying objects.
This is so secret, there have been very few people in our entire government that have been allowed or provided access to it. If the capabilities that exist become known to the world, it might very well be that it is to the benefit of mankind.
I never really understood why all that is so secret, so we'll be finding out about that. But first of all, Hong Kong, it holds a legislative election today to elect new lawmakers to the 90-member Legislative Council, but the candidates have been vetted for patriotism. Pro-democracy candidates largely absent, having decided not to run or been jailed or forced into exile. The election comes 11 days after that massive fire which engulfed seven tower blocks, killing at least 159 people. So what's the mood in Hong Kong today? Well, earlier I spoke to our reporter there, Danny Vincent, who was outside a polling station.
I'm in the northeast of Hong Kong and I've been speaking to candidates and current lawmakers and people standing in line and polling about to cast their vote in this election. This election is considered a patriot-only election. That means only people that are vetted by Beijing, approved by Beijing and seen as patriotic are able to stand. Now, in 2020, Beijing imposed a national security law on Hong Kong. Many people say that it's been silencing dissenting voices, opposition voices. Many, if not most, of the traditional opposition voices here in Hong Kong, they are either in exile or they have been imprisoned. So many people say that this is an example of the erosion of freedoms that was once promised to Hong Kong. But the authorities say this is a free and fair election, and they're looking forward to a new generation of lawmaker coming into office in Hong Kong. They say that, this next generation is needed to help reform issues relating to the fire that happened 11 days ago.
Yeah, well, tell us about the fire. What are people saying about that?
Well, there's a mixture of sorrow, mourning, and also anger. The authorities have launched an investigation into the causes of the fire. They've already pointed out that there were some substandard materials used that helped to spread the fire at an unusually fast rate. But at the same time, there have also been members of the public that have called for an independent investigation before the authorities launched one. And there have been people that have been arrested for essentially speaking out like that. I spoke to a lawmaker today. They said that these individuals that were arrested, the suspicion was sedition. They say they've now been released, but many members of the public, they feel that the fire itself has become a very politically sensitive event, because some people are simply afraid to criticise the government or to simply speak out and ask questions about how this fire began.
Right. Well, you describe the elections, I mean, the authorities describe the elections as free and fair, but as you say, it's all pre-selected. So what does all that mean for turnout?
Well, that's the big question. The last time, the first Patriot-only election, the turnout was around 30%. The election before that, before the reform of the electoral system, turnout was roughly twice that. So it's here on the ground, observers and also just ordinary Hong Kong residents, they see the turnout as a type of vote of confidence in the authorities. Now, a lawmaker, a pro-Beijing lawmaker that I spoke to today, they said that, you know, perhaps the turnout could be low because of, you know, the society is still mourning from this tragic fire. But many critics, they certainly see the potential low turnout. We don't know what the turnout is yet, but they see that as an indicator of how much confidence the public have with this government.
And that was Danny Vincent, BBC reporter in Hong Kong. Now, we've still got our panel with us. Sophie Lombin, who runs a company talking about how to make a more sustainable economy, and Phil Cox, who makes documentaries. Sophie, I know you've got a new report you've just been producing called The Courage to Think Clearly. It's about the responsibility of business executives?
Yes, that's right. So the premise of the report is that in an age of converging crises, whether the climate disruption, biodiversity loss, or widening inequality and deepening polarization, trust in institutions is clearly eroding. Confidence in government to lead on the biggest challenges we face at historic low, and the recent COP event in Belém was another manifestation of that. So instead of uniting us, the complexity of this crisis seems to be fueling a division. And you know, this politicization has left many national leaders struggling to set coherent agenda, and fragmented leadership has weakened responses to both these domestic and international levels.
Yeah, but it seems a bit unfair to me to hit business executives with all of this, because, you know, they've got customers, some of whom don't agree with you about any of this stuff. And doesn't it risk, you know, if you're a business executive and you take a prominent role on climate change issues, doesn't that risk alienating some of your custom?
Well, yes. I mean, business and civil society are not free from that trust deficit. And yes, they have some various stakeholders they need to take into account. But they, on one hand, they're often seen as more credible than government. So they inspire trust. And with that level of trust, I suppose, comes a level of responsibility and an opening to take a bit more of a position on those issues. Also, they have lots of self-interest, because the future of their business and the viability of their business is, is at stake. So I think to step forward with courage, not to inflame division, but to help societies face this tension honestly and deepen the understanding of what really at stake, for me, is really part of the duty of business leaders.
But when you say there's, I mean, I take your point that their businesses in the long term will depend on the environment. But, you know, we all know that the City of London and New York and all the rest of them, they operate on, what, 6 months? You know, profits now. You know, very few companies are able to invest for the long term, given the pressures of the stock market. So does that, you know, is that a challenge for these business execs that you're saying, look, long term, you need to do this? And they're saying, well, that's not so easy, actually.
Yeah, no, I'm completely sympathetic to the pressure they feel in the short term. Good business leadership is to be able to look beyond the quarterly earnings in the next 6 months. Proofing your value chain and your supply chain is critical to the long-term business of your company. I think basically, our stance here is that the risk of
engagement is real, but that the risk of disengagement and inaction is greater. And the silence of business leaders, that, you know, these ways businesses carry so much power when you think about an influence, when you think about the capital flows that are going through them, the data they own, the people they hire, there's a real duty and responsibility to meaningfully engage in these debates.
No, I really see that you know, business executives are powerful. And anyway, one of them's here, Phil Cox, got a business making documentaries. I hope you've been listening to what Sophie's saying and that you're taking on the challenge.
Yeah, I wondered, you know, from a kind of factual perspective, surely the future is so obvious that it has to become renewables at some point, and fossil fuels have a temporary lifespan. Why is that just not become the business model that everybody's chasing? I mean, if you're looking forward, it seems so clearly predictable and an opportunity. And people have talked about how China's embracing that and speeding it. Why is it being so slow?
Well, I mean, there's many things at stake here, but I think business are embracing this agenda very proactively. Obviously, you need the infrastructure, you need the investment, you need a consumer base that is willing to embrace those practices or those products as well. But I think there is no doubt that business is investing towards the green economy, certainly not at the pace and speeds that we need. And we'll talk about this later in the program. But I have no doubt that the transition is well underway. And there's many stories that are not told that prove the extent to which there's a sort of an exponential adoption, and we'll talk about electric vehicle later in the program of those practices.
Now, Phil, just hear a bit about your documentaries, because you're obviously a very busy bloke, and you've got Sicilian fishermen, and you've got motor neurone disease, all these amazing topics that you're covering, important topics and interesting topics. But I imagine it must be very difficult to place these things. You know, you're making films. You have to sell them to a very limited number of people. Yeah, there are broadcasters, there's Netflix and the streamers, there's the state broadcasters, BBC and the like. Very small market, right? How difficult is it?
Well, I think if you're going to create solely defined by the market, you're simply going to reproduce formulaic stuff that's already there. So for me, I mean, creatively, it's exciting to try and look beyond that and look at new ways of storytelling. And at the beginning, you won't have a market for that. So at Native Voice Films, we often embark sort of self-financing and trying to, in our collaborations, finding new ways to tell the story that won't sit well with a traditional broadcaster. So like Khartoum, the film we just made, Five Citizens Escape Khartoum and the War. In the end, we've told that through animation, theatre and reconstruction and dreamscapes and each of the characters dreaming. And at the beginning, the broadcasters were just completely scared off. And that was fine by us because we managed to move forward controlling the narrative, controlling the way we wanted to make it. And in the end, the film, you know, won awards at festivals and the broadcasters have jumped in. But it's that balance, I think. If you want to take chances, if you want to dare in your storytelling, both politically and creatively, then often you'll be walking the first steps alone.
And are you making things directly for YouTube and other platforms like that? And can you, does that work for you?
No, we still want to feel we reach an audience alongside that or beyond it. I mean, our first step is often festival cinema, and then we'll go to broadcasters in the US or France or here. You know, I think it's a lot about what we're making. Now we're doing a trilogy of dreams, the Khartoum being the first one, and now with Sicilian Fishermen and the Changing Mediterranean. And then the last with MND Sufferers in the UK. And that's a collaboration with the Wellcome Trust, Manchester University.
So Wellcome Trust is a big health charity.
A big science, yeah. So it's about you find partners beyond traditional broadcasters.
I see. So really, for the funding of it, you're looking for, you know, foundations and charities as well as the broadcasters.
Yeah, and how can we keep autonomy as storytellers? How can we keep a creative control? I mean, television, it can be amazing, but it can become very formulaic. So if you want to be an auteur, if you want to step outside that, you need other partners. So the projects now that Native Voice Films is doing has that.
Thank you very much. We'll be back to both of you later, Phil Cox and Sophie Lombin. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. And a couple of the latest headlines. Police in India say more than 20 people have been killed in a fire at a nightclub in Goa. And Russia has carried out new missile and drone attacks on Ukraine overnight as diplomatic activity intensifies on ending the war in Ukraine. We're turning now to one of the biggest of all the unanswered questions out there. Are we alone in the universe? Age of Disclosure is a new feature-length documentary, not made by Phil, but nonetheless featuring interviews with dozens of high-ranking officials in the United States, talking about the possibility of UFOs in our skies. It covers secret government efforts to study what those objects spotted by credible military pilots might be, and how the US Congress is now trying to get to the bottom of it all. The film is available online. The Weekend's Tim Smith caught up with the director, Dan Farrer, to hear more about what it reveals.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the AFA. My God.
What you're hearing now comes from a video released by the US Department of Defense in 2020, showing a disc-shaped object turning slowly on its axis, with the Pentagon described as an unidentified aerial phenomenon, or a UAP.
We're going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west.
A year later, President Obama backed up claims by US Navy pilots who went on the record saying they'd witnessed objects also captured on radar that flew in ways that defied the known laws of physics.
There's footage and records of objects in the skies that we don't know exactly what they are. We can't explain how they moved.
Now a new documentary, Age of Disclosure, seeks to get to the bottom of the UAP mystery. Dan Farrer is the director.
I interviewed 34 high-level members of the U.S. government, military, and intelligence communities. Everyone interviewed in the film has direct knowledge of the UAP issue as a result of their work for the U.S. government.
One of those in the film is the now U.S. Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Marco Rubio.
We've had repeated instances of something operating in the airspace over restricted nuclear facilities, and it's not ours, and we don't know whose it is. That alone, just that statement alone, deserves inquiry, deserves attention. Even presidents have been operating on a need-to-know basis, but that begins to ramp out of control. Some people claim it would cost them their lives if they spoke out about these things.
The Age of Disclosure features a number of impressive interviewees, like Lieutenant General James Clapper.
I served as the fourth Director of National Intelligence.
One of them, Brett Federson, a senior official during the Obama administration, makes a striking claim in the documentary's trailer.
Director of Aviation Security in the National Security Council, we are absolutely not alone.
Dan, why do you think people of this seniority are speaking out on this issue now?
I've come to the conclusion after interviewing them that they participated because they felt the public needed to know the base facts of this very urgent situation. And they're breaking their silence in this film with what they lawfully can disclose.
Age of Disclosure also tells the story of how the US Congress is now trying to get to the bottom of what videos like these might show, with Representative Ana Paulina Luna leading public hearings on UAP.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Good morning and welcome to the hearing regarding UAP disclosures. For too long, the issue of unidentified anomalous phenomena, commonly known as UAPs, has been shrouded in secrecy, stigma, and in some cases, outright dismissal. Today, I want to state clearly that this is not science fiction or creating speculation. This is about national security, government accountability, and the American people's right to the truth.
There is an unprecedented bipartisan push in Congress to bring about disclosure of what the U.S. government knows about UAP and non-human intelligent life. There are three core leaders in Congress, Senator Rounds, who's a Republican, Senator Schumer, and Senator Gillibrand, who are Democrats. The three of them have co-sponsored an historic piece of legislation called the UAP Disclosure Act, and they are actively fighting to get that signed into law by the end of this year. You can read this legislation that they've proposed. It's online. They use the words non-human intelligent life dozens of times. So the hope is that this film helps rally the support that they need to get that piece of legislation over the line.
And Dan, beyond national security and the obvious curiosity that people might have, why is it worth Congress trying to investigate UAPs and the alleged secrecy surrounding them?
Something else that the interview subjects in my film reveal is that this technology that UAP are displaying, so far superior to any technology we have, that leaning into researching it and studying it more could lead to tremendous technological progress and impact the way we live. If we can figure out their energy source, that could solve the energy crisis. One of the senior people in my film is Senator Mike Rounds from South Dakota. He's an extremely well-respected senior member of Congress, and he's aware of a lot of classified information on this topic. And one of the things he is able to talk about lawfully in the film is the impact that this technology could have if we find a safe way to share it with the public.
This is so secret. There have been very few people in our entire government that have been allowed or provided access to it. If the capabilities that exist become known to the world, it might very well be that it is to the benefit of mankind.
Well, I would have thought so. Senator Mike Rounds ending that report from Tim Smith, and still with me, Sophie Lombard and Phil Cox. Phil, great topic for a documentary.
Yeah.
Not your sort of thing?
I got me thinking about Orson Welles in 1938, the War of the Worlds radio announcements and everyone panicking, and I kind of love of a deep, scary story.
Let me explain, that was a radio documentary which was made in the United States saying that Martians had landed in New York and everyone panicked.
I mean, I'm sure and I hope there is intelligent life out there and they come and visit us on our blue planet and look with despair at what we're doing and hopefully sort us out. That would be great. I mean, when I, as a filmmaker, you know, you also look at how things are put together and dramatic music and sound bites and short statements. So, and that's exactly kind of what this was. And it compels you on an emotional storytelling level of like a wanting to believe and a base of kind of fear of what out's there.
Can I just ask you, I'm wondering if that's not what you do.
No, I mean, I that's what puts me off, actually. But it's effective. Just like Orson Welles'
thing. Well, the sort of hyping it up.
Hyping it up, dramatic music, short statements, you know, quick emotive engagement and the unknown, you know, our base fear. But let's see. I mean, I hope that I hope they come and sort us out.
Sophie Longwell, what did you make of what you heard?
Well, I watched the film last night.
Okay.
And I have to say, I was not prepared to be that surprised by how compelling the evidence seems to be. But yes, there was lots of dramatic music and short bites. But also, you know, I just felt, is it a don't look up moment? You know, there seemed to be not only lots of evidence, but lots of concealing of evidence as well, which I think reveals, you know, how we behave faced with an unknown.
And was it clear to you from the film why all this has been concealed? Because on the face of it, there is no reason whatsoever to conceal government research, which we've all paid for, into something which concerns us all. I mean, why shouldn't we know?
Well, I think at a human level, it's probably because people don't know enough, therefore don't know what to do with that, and it's potentially hugely threatening, huge geopolitical implication. They talk a lot about if China gets hold of that information before Russia, before the US. So that has big political implications. But this program has been going forever. And I had no idea. And I think I suddenly came out feeling that it deserved proper scientific exploration and some level of transparency.
Did you leave watching the film thinking there's something out there?
Yes. And certainly wanting to do much more research myself about it.
Gosh. Did you not think that before you saw the film?
Definitely not. I thought it was a joke. And wow. They also show in the film, documentary, how much he's been, you know, designed to ridicule. And this concept of non-human intelligent life is absolutely terrifying. But yeah, definitely wanting to find out more.
Phil, having not seen the film, I'm afraid I'm in the position of no.
Yeah, I mean, I did see bits. I mean, I'm a skeptic, I'm afraid.
Right.
And I kind of see the film as a kind of creation. But I really hope there is, and that they come and visit.
One day.
If I may say, I hope they wait a little bit before coming and visit, because we don't have a very coherent picture to share.
Well, we've got a ticking clock on the planet. Maybe they can come and sort us out, and
yes,
environmentally it would be great.
Okay, we're going to rely on UFOs to look after all our problems. Thanks for the moment. We'll be back to you all later. That was Sophie Lombard and Phil Cox. You're listening to Weekend on the World Service of the BBC.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content. Engaging audiences, creating meaningful experiences, and fostering conversations. APM, American Public Media, with support from Ninja One, helping organizations simplify endpoint management to automate IT and strengthen security, all from one platform. More at ninjaone.com.
This month marks Jane Austen's 250th birthday. Fans say her characters resonate as much as ever for both women and men.
Modern men struggle to find good role models. Her heroes show how men can be men, do masculine things, make the world a better place.
Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 5 here on KQED News.
It's 7:30 GMT. This is Weekend from the BBC World Service. And still to come, a year after the fall of President Assad, are Syrians thinking it's time to go back home? And as some around the world prepare for Christmas, what favourite Christmas movies will be coming up on TV? And we'll have more from our panel all on Weekend after this summary of the latest world news.
BBC News with Eileen McHugh. At least 25 people have been killed and dozens injured in a fire at a nightclub in the Indian state of Goa. The majority of victims are believed to be staff at the club's kitchen. The cause of the fire is under investigation. Russia has carried out new missile and drone attacks overnight, targeting infrastructure in central Ukraine. There were multiple explosions in the city of Kremenchuk. Power and water supplies have been disrupted. It comes as talks aimed at ending the war have intensified in Europe and the US. Residents in Hong Kong are voting in local elections days after one of the deadliest fires in the city for decades. Only 20 of the 90 seats are directly elected as part of an electoral system overhaul by China. Japan says Chinese fighter jets directed their radar at Japanese military aircraft in two separate incidents on Saturday. The Chinese Navy disputed Tokyo's account. The German Chancellor Friedrich Merz is in Israel, where he's due to hold talks with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The leaders are expected to discuss the next stage of a US peace plan for Gaza. The Sudanese government says a drone attack on Thursday in South Kordofan hit a kindergarten, killing 79 people, including 43 children. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, called it a horrific violation of children's rights. Australia has declared natural disasters in six areas in New South Wales, where fire crews are battling dozens of wildfires. More than 12 homes and vast areas of bushland were destroyed. And the Formula One Championship will be decided later today in the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. McLaren's Lando Norris is the favourite to win the race. He only needs to finish on the podium to win the title, regardless of anyone else's result. That's the latest from BBC World News.
You're listening to Weekend from the BBC World Service with Owen Bennett-Jones. Well, tomorrow marks a year since the fall of the Assad regime in Syria after that lightning offensive involving several opposition groups led by the Sunni Islam Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS. Its leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa, was appointed president earlier this year. And since the end of Assad's 24-year regime, more than 1 million Syrian refugees and under 2 million internally displaced have gone back to their homes. That's a UN statistic. And Abdul Karim Exayez is a doctor now living in Damascus who is one of those. He's moved back to Syria this year. We're also going to hear from Zaina Kanawati, Senior Communications Officer for Women for Women. It's an international NGO. She's in Berlin, thinking of going back. Well, I've been speaking to them, and Abdul Karim Exayez began by telling us why he originally decided to leave Syria.
So when Aleppo was split between the regime and the oppositions, I had to move in between the both areas to work both in a governmental area on one side and in a field hospital in a basement of a mosque on the other side. So when this person whispered to me that the security agencies are looking for me, this meant to me that I would be arrested and I might be killed under torture, similar to two other friends who faced the same fate. So I went straight out of the operation theater. I changed my clothes. I dressed as like a normal civilian. I shaved my beard just to change the way I look. And then I sat next to a patient pretending that, you know, I'm just a normal civilian. So the security agencies, they scrutinized every single corner in the hospital for about 2 hours. And when they finished, it was about like midnight. Then that's when I decided I should not be in a regime held areas anymore. So I left the hospital. I sneaked out, actually. I went to my in-laws' house and I decided I need to leave.
So you got away from the hospital and then basically, to cut a long story short, you ended up in London.
Yes, actually, yeah. So I was able to get away from that situation. So I decided to leave to the opposition held areas. At that point, I had no plan to leave the country. But then I worked in field hospitals in the opposition held areas in Northwest. I participated in the public health programs like the polio and the measles eradication campaigns. I worked with Save the Children. So, and then I got a scholarship, actually, to continue my education. So I traveled to London in 2016.
And you, I should say, succeeded in London. You studied and you did very well in London. But you took this decision to go back to Syria. And we're about to hear from Zaina Kanawati, who is making the decision as to whether she should go back. So tell us about your experience of returning.
So after the operation, I made 3 visits to Syria where I was assessing the situation. And I was keen to go back to witness these historical moments that the country is going through. So I went back to London again and I discussed with my wife, even my little daughters. I have 3 daughters, 10, 8 and 2. Though the 10 and 8, I discussed with them about our plans to go back to Syria. They were a bit hesitant. But then I thought, let's go back during summer and visit. So we went back in July. They really enjoyed being in Syria during the summer between Aleppo, Homs, Damascus and Idlib. So we decided, let's give it a try. So we stayed. And now we've been about like 4 months here. Where we live is very stable in Damascus. And the services were slightly better than I imagined. And also the security situation in Damascus is good. But again, I think in other governorates, things are slightly unstable. But I think broadly, things are going in the right direction.
Well, it's very interesting to hear your story. And it must be of interest to Zaina Kanawati, as I said, who's thinking about this. And you've been away from Syria since 2007, so it's a long time. But as I understand it, you are thinking of going back. What do you think of what you've just heard?
Actually, I have visited Syria for the first time this year in 10 years to visit my family, because during the past 10 years, I was not able to go back because of my work as a journalist against the previous regime. So this year when I went back, I felt that, yes, I want to go back to my country, but I also didn't feel very well to bring back my children there, to be honest.
Right. And I mean, the doctor's done it. Might you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's different for everyone because you cannot just go back after being outside your country for 10 years or more. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy decision to make, you know, to change the whole life. And especially that I don't feel that the infrastructure is reliable there. And there are still so many security and safety issues that I'm waiting a little bit to see how it's going to develop.
Okay, Doctor, what would you say to Zaina as she's thinking about this?
So I had very similar issues to consider. But I think, as I mentioned, I was slightly surprised that the infrastructure in some areas is much better than I imagined. So in the area where I live, I get better services than the ones I used to get in London, really, in terms of electricity, water, healthcare, education for the kids. There are some differences and some challenges, especially when it comes to schooling, the different educational systems. But I think the services are much better than I expected.
Zaina, what would you want to ask the doctor for some reassurance on particular points?
As I told you, it depends on everyone's situation, because he might be really centered in a good place in Damascus, but where I went to visit my family, we didn't have water for, like, it comes every 3 days for 2 hours. It wasn't enough even for 3 people, and the electricity was really cutting so much. So I'm not quite sure yet. And also, I need to add on top of this, the situation for women in Syria is not specifically what I'm hoping for yet.
Doctor, let's just deal with that last point. You've got a wife and three daughters, you said. How are they finding it?
So, as I mentioned initially, they were very hesitant. I think they are enjoying the social life in Syria, which is very enjoyable for them. But I do agree with Zena that in some locations it's better than the others. And to be honest, it might be very costly to ensure that those services are available in some of the areas. While the majority of the country, they do not have this infrastructure, or it's not available, or it's not affordable for all people. And that's why I think for people who have maybe their income from outside the country, it might be easier for them to go back.
Yeah, well, okay, there's the money issue. But just on Zaina's point about attitudes to women in Syria, have they noticed a big difference between their lives in London and their lives in Damascus?
To be honest, I was trying to put them in a protective environment so far, because, again, I was not going to risk them being exposed to unprotected environment.
Yes, and Zaina, you might not want to be in a protected environment, I guess.
I mean, it's different for everyone, and I really respect Abdul Karim's experience there, but I feel also that it's a bit risky for a journalist who wants to really cover what's happening and who wants to move freely and be able to deliver the voices of especially women in Syria. So in this specific career I have, I don't feel safe in Syria yet.
Yeah, different being a doctor to a journalist maybe, Zaina.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
So, what's going to happen? You're going to sit it out, I think, aren't you, in Berlin?
Yes.
Okay. And doctor, you're going to stay there and enjoy it.
Yeah. So far, so we are reassessing the situation every couple of months. And as I mentioned, so far, I think the country is heading into the right directions. And I do agree this might not be the same for everyone or for every career, but we are reassessing the situation every couple of months.
And that was Dr. Abdul Karim Exayez in Damascus, and we heard from Zaina Kanawati also in Berlin. And we're going back to Damascus now, because the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is there. So you're there, presumably, Lise, because it's a year on since the fall of Assad. Can you give us some impression of what's changed in the last year?
Very interesting listening to the conversation, Owen. In some senses, they're right. It's really good that Dr. Karim has come back. Syria does need its doctors. But it is true that everyone I've spoken to, and I've just been in Damascus this time, but I hear from people elsewhere, is that the services situation is not good. There are power cuts every day, just like there was under the previous regime. The water situation has actually got worse, because Israel has occupied the heights of an area which was a key source of water. But if you have the resources to get a generator to buy your water from tankers, you can live a decent life here in Syria. So it really depends on who you are and how much resources you have. In general, Owen, people say they do feel freer, that they can speak out more. The social freedoms that they worried about when I was here last year at this time, for example, in the old city, its famous restaurants and bars are still open. Some women say they feel a bit more pressure now, that this is still a country where you see some women wearing headscarves, some women not wearing headscarves. This is a very diverse society, but I'm told by Syrian women friends that more women are covering up just because they feel the environment is a bit more conservative. But in general, it hasn't turned out in many areas as bad as some might have feared. But if you live on the coastal areas with the minority Alawites, who were the main supporters of President Assad, the reports from there are people speaking of fear, of kidnapping of women. There was, of course, the killings in the spring of this year. In the south, in Druze areas, there is also a lot of tension. And, of course, Israel continues to attack the country. So it's very, very much, and not surprisingly, a mixed picture.
Yeah, it just sounds, there was so much violence and so many different groups that it must be very fragile, you'd think. I mean, it just seems astonishing that it's gone as well as it has.
Yes, it's a country of many different communities, but the violence was mainly concentrated on the coastal area, among the Alawite community, and in the Druze areas, where hundreds were killed in violence there. In Damascus, you don't feel that. I've been asking people, including people, I have to say, Owen, that everywhere we go, we meet Syrians who've just come back. Some are here just to visit. Mm-hmm. Some are coming back to and coming back for good, although leaving their families wherever they live. But some say, well, we don't walk at night. We're still not certain. But you don't feel that heavy sense of oppression and the ubiquitous spies that you used to under President Assad's regime. And I have to say, Owen, we're staying now in the center of the city, and the celebrations for tomorrow have already been going on for days. You are going to see the images of people filling the squares, not just here. We've seen the pictures in Homs, in Aleppo. There still is a sense for, no matter how bad it is, for the majority of Syrians, not for, of course, for the staunch supporters of President Assad, for the majority of Syrians, this is still better than what they had before. And they're still hoping that for whatever questions they have about their new president, he has been a very skilled diplomat on the world stage. They just need the international community to do more to fully lift the sanctions, for investors to come back, for Syria to get on its feet. Don't forget, this is a country where 90% of the people live below the poverty line.
Now, Lee, stay with us. We've got a top panel here, Sophie Lombard and Phil Cox. And Sophie's got a question for you.
Hello, Liz. I have a question in the context of the very live discussion in Europe about asylum seekers and immigration. And my question is what do you say to the voices who suggest that asylum seekers move to countries in Europe because of the comforts it provides and the social security coverage? What is your response to those voices?
Well, if you're speaking specifically about Syrians, you'll remember there was a huge wave of Syrians in 2015 where Angela Merkel and others, the German leader at the time, said, we can do this, we can open our doors, we can take care of them. And as we've been hearing in this discussion, Syrians the world over are making individual decisions about whether to come back. I think there's no denying that Syrians love for their country, their relief that a new chapter is starting, despite all the questions. They would prefer to come home. But equally, to reiterate what our two Syrian guests said, they need to know that the services are there, their children can go to school, that they are safe. I think this is a really important time for Syria. They don't want to be pushed out of where they are. They want to have time. And remember, even in Germany, there was some officials were saying, we can't have the Syrians leaving. The Syrian doctors have made a huge difference to our healthcare system.
And Phil, you have something to ask too?
Yeah, hello. It's just two very brief questions. How free are our colleagues, our journalist colleagues there to criticise al-Sharia? What are you sort of seeing from our journalist colleagues and their ability to work freely? And just finally, what sort of pressure is he under to somehow have a coherent response to the Israeli bombing and incursions happening near the Golan Heights in the south? Is there within the population pressure for him to solve that and stop it?
These are really important questions. I think on the media situation, it's still being tested. The journalists we speak to say they do feel freer, and there has been criticism in public of al-Sharia, and they're still feeling their way and whether or not this is going to change or not. Bear in mind that initially there was all the euphoria about the end of the Assad family's rule, that a lot of the coverage was positive, and discussing with Syrian journalists, some of them saying, oh yes, we can make criticism now, and others saying, well, it's still within limits. So I think this one is still playing out. On Israel, the United States and others have been trying to find a way to reduce the tension. There's been a lot of criticism internationally and in the region of Israel's continuing strikes. Israel, of course, says it's for its own security. It wants to establish a buffer zone between the Golan Heights and Syria. President Ahmed al-Sharia was speaking about this in the Doha Forum and saying we are trying to have a better relationship with Syria. There have been talks in Europe that the United States has tried to organize, but the bombing doesn't stop.
Okay. Thanks very much, Lise. That's Lise Doucette in Damascus. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with Weekend. And a reminder of the main news now. Police in India say more than 20 people have been killed in a fire at a nightclub in Goa. And Russia has carried out new missile and drone attacks on Ukraine overnight as diplomatic activity intensifies on ending the war in Ukraine. Christmas, the festive season, is about to get into full swing in some parts of the world. And if you're a film lover, there will be plenty of old and new Christmas movies that you might want to be watching. Here in the UK, the British Board of Film Classification, BBFC, has released the results of a survey it carried out asking members of the British public to nominate favourite Christmas movies. The most popular, with 20% of the vote, was Home Alone, starring Macaulay Culkin as an 8-year-old boy mistakenly left at home who defends the house against a pair of burglars on Christmas Eve.
Where are you going? We're going to miss the plane!
When the McAllister family left on their Christmas vacation...
Did we miss the plane? No, you just made it.
Yeah!
They forgot one small thing.
Have yourself...
I have a terrible feeling.
Christmas.
Did you lock up?
Let yeah.
Yourself be light.
Do we set the timers on the lights?
Mm-hmm. What else could we be forgetting?
Our troubles will be ours.
Kevin!
Home Alone.
Never seen it. Should one day. Next most popular was Love Actually, romantic comedy. Dominic Heckles is the Director of Communications at the British Board of Film Classification who did this survey. So she told me a bit more about what it reveals.
Yeah, well, we spoke to 2,000 people across the UK aged 16 and over. And what we found, as you said, Home Alone ranked the number one, followed by Love Actually. It's a Wonderful Life came in at number 3, and Elf came in at number 4. So a real range of films there.
Yeah, it's a real range of films. I was trying to work out what they've got in common, because it's some are quite new, some are quite old. What's the common theme?
Well, so we asked audiences what makes the perfect Christmas film, and according to the British public, a heartwarming story came up as number 1, and that was followed by a family-friendly tone and humour in at number 3. And I think if you look at sort of the top 5 to top 10, they're all some rated U or PG. They're all very, you know, pretty much family friendly. They have that Christmas spirit in them, you know, good versus evil. So I think that's what they all seem to have in common.
And quite a few about Christmas, but just trying to think, not all.
Not all, no. I mean, it's a long-running debate, isn't it, about Die Hard, and that was one of our questions that we put to the public. And what we found is nearly half of people said that Die Hard is not a Christmas film. But it was really close, because 38% said yes, and 17% remain undecided. And actually 5% of people said it was their favourite Christmas film. So it's set at Christmas, but obviously it's action-packed, so lots of different arguments on either side of the debate, I think.
I have to say, I was unaware of this great debate. So Die Hard, Bruce Willis, isn't it, and sort of...
Bruce Willis.
Violent thriller, is it? And I can't imagine why anyone would think it was a Christmas film.
It's Christmas Eve in L.A. But a team of terrorists have their own holiday plans.
And I'm telling you, you're just going to have to kill me.
Okay.
But the one thing they didn't plan on was New York cop John McClane.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
Well, look, I think, you know, it's set at Christmas. Me personally, I think it is. It's set at Christmas. You know, all Bruce Willis wants to do is, you know, plays John McClane, is reconcile with his family, spend Christmas with his family. Uh-huh. It's all about good versus evil. I don't want to give too many spoilers away. But, you know, on either side of the debate, I think you can weigh it either way. And actually what we found when we did ask about what makes a perfect Christmas film, 4% said action and adventure packed. So,
yeah, 4%, not many. And The Sound of Music, which... doesn't have any Christmas reference at all in it that I can think of. It always was a classic Christmas film. I don't know whether it's still shown quite as much at Christmas as it used to be, but that didn't make your list at all.
No, it didn't. No, it didn't make the list. So, yeah, so it's not in, the, well, certainly not in the top 10, and I don't think it was in any of the other answers either. I think one person decided Terrifier 3 was one of their favourite Christmas films, but that was one in the survey 2000.
Lots of people making, you know, pop music, other sorts of music, are try to crack into the Christmas market each year with various offerings. Is it like that with films, that some of them are designed for the Christmas market?
Well, I think, you know, I can't go into whatever every director sort of intends for their film, but I think, you know, what we found is audiences, you know, a snowy location, Father Christmas, you know, a Christmas theme tune does help, and that did come back in some of the findings.
Yours is a British survey. Have you got any sort of impression, even if just anecdotal, of how that compares with, you know, audiences around the world? I mean, do Christmas films work in non-Christian countries?
Well, I don't have any recent findings on that, but I mean, as the British Board of Film Classification, we're all about what British audiences want and expect to see on screen. And I think this, you know, came through really clearly. And what we've also found is that, you know, we wanted to look at what, you know, families are doing around the UK in terms of checking age ratings. And we do find that over half of people are actually looking at ratings. And, you know, when they're choosing something for their family over the Christmas period. So, I think that guidance is pretty crucial.
And on your point about the age ratings, that's what you do. This is when you classify films and sort of say they're appropriate for different ages. And I guess at Christmas, the point is it's granny and grandpa and the toddler. I mean, it's everyone.
Yeah, that's what we're assuming, particularly from those top 10 Christmas films. And actually, in the spirit of Christmas, we found, we asked people, you know, who has the final say on film night. And we found that 1/5 of people said nobody in particular. So it really is sort of a family-friendly watch, a group decision. And 15% said it is a family vote. So there you go, people are sitting down over the Christmas period with their family.
So these are democratic Christmases.
Yes, exactly that.
Well, that was Dominic Heckles there from the British Board of Film Classification. Still with us just before we close this hour of the programme, our panel, Sophie Lombin and Phil Cox. Sophie, you are originally Belgian. Do the Belgians have better things to do than watch TV at Christmas? I'm sure they do.
Yes, yeah, so my mother certainly thinks so.
She's a fan of TV, does she?
TV would not be seen suitable at all for Christmas night. But it's certainly a practice we've adopted in a very multicultural household, Belgian, Indian, and two very British children.
That's what you've got?
That's okay. What I've got, yeah. So okay. I think, I didn't know Love Actually was the second one, but Love Actually has become a tradition.
Ah.
Quintessentially British in so many ways, but I think the common thread, it's about, you know, the love of being together, however dysfunctional it might be. I think that's the common thread.
And, Phil, are you, as a Brit, a victim of the desire to see these things?
We have a kind of collective memory of that day and family and what happens. I mean, for me, it was a James Bond film, avoiding the washing up, avoiding the Sound of Music, the Brussels sprouts. And it's kind of a family moment where people are present, whether unconscious, watching or not. And there's sort of the films of Muppets, Trading Places, Bond or whatever it is. They kind of stay with you as a part of your childhood memory of the Christmas event, the day.
What do you make of this idea of voting on the Christmas movie? Or do you think there should be paternal, you know, rule? Maternal rule. Parental rule is what I mean.
Yeah, I guess it's it's turned into anarchy in the living room on Christmas afternoon. It's who's awake and who's not washing up probably gets to have the final vote.
Sophie, there is another aspect of TV in the UK at Christmas, which was the Queen always used to give her address, and no doubt the King now gives his address. And it used to be absolutely appointment viewing for the older generation. You know, the grandmothers of our generation would just insist that everyone sat down and watched the Queen. Have you ever, in your multicultural home, has that ever happened? Do you take notice of what the monarch has to say at Christmas?
Well, we have a king in Belgium, so yes.
Ah, I see, so you're watching the Belgian king.
We were watching the my grandmother was suddenly with this same kind of three-line whip.
We should
all watch it together. So that was an easier one to adopt here.
And what sort of thing? Was the Belgian king, same sort of thing, sort of community,
yes,
solidarity?
Yes, state of the nation type moment. And yes, reflection on, solidarity, reflection on family values, this kind of feel-good speech.
Phil, I didn't realise wherever there's a monarch, there probably is a Christmas address. Was your family, you know, stuck? Did you have?
I think we watched it with a lot of humour, usually. But it's just part of that routine of the day and the period. I mean, as a filmmaker, there's some great other Christmas movies. There's a famous one of the first ones, 1913, The Night Before Christmas, like a Russian director. It's like a horror. And the idea of that changing period of wintertime to tradition. But, you know, I think as British Christmas participants, television, the Queen's speech, and falling unconscious as part of the day.
I do think that the agreement on the film should be made pre-Christmas, otherwise there's a risk of endless debates.
Yes, you want to sort that out before before Christmas Eve even. Okay, well, look, thanks very much, and we'll be coming back to you in the next hour here on the BBC World Service. You're listening to Weekend with Owen Bennett-Jones.
It's been a heavy year in the news, but at NPR, we always find time for a break.
Earlier this week, we reported on octopuses. Octopi?
A chance to dish with a friend.
Everything comes back to Love Island.
Love Island, everything. Or a quick nosh.
I mean, warm and potatoy on the inside and then the hint of onion. Oh.
Give back to the station that brings you joy and wonder, along with the news, by making your gift today.
Give at kqed.org/donate.
Hi there, I'm Rand Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today. And thanks.
You're listening to KQED.